Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
It's the Brian Lehrer Show on WNYC. Good morning again, everyone. We'll spend some time now talking about the role of Steve Bannon in the Trump administration and looking at his beliefs. Bannon, as most of you know, was executive chairman of the conservative populist Breitbart website before joining the Trump campaign. He is now Trump's chief strategist, but also seems to be playing a central policy, not just strategy or political role. He reportedly wrote much of the inaugural address, has been given a seat on the National Security Council, a vital policy role, and crafted much of the 90-day, seven-country travel ban seen by critics as the first volley in a broader Muslim ban and even religious war. Here is a montage of Bannon statements that lend some credence to that critique. USA Today put this montage together this week from moments on Bannon's own radio show on Breitbart, things he said in the last year, year and a half before leaving Breitbart for the campaign.
You know, George Bush walked out after 9/11 in front of a mosque that's religion of peace and go shopping, right? We haven't had an adult conversation. And by the way, some of these conversations may get a little unpleasant. But you know what? We're in a war. We're clearly going into, a major shooting war in the Middle East again. It's war. It's war. Every day we put up America's at war. America's at war. We're at war. Note to self, beloved commander-in-chief. We're at war.
You have an expansionist Islam and you have an expansionist China, right? They are motivated. They're arrogant. They're on the march and they think the Judeo-Christian West is on the retreat. Talk to us about this mosque in the North Pole.
Various Steve Bannon statements from his Breitbart radio show in the last year and a half before he joined the Trump campaign. Here's one more example. This is Bannon on Breitbart, knocking not just radical Islamists, but Islam as a religion overall in the context of knocking George W. Bush in this Breitbart radio clip last year.
Well, you know, George Bush did look into Vladimir Putin's eyes and what he said, he saw a evangelical Christian, a deeply religious man. Was that not the
yes,
only
sir.
Only the dumbest, the second dumbest comment that one of the dumbest presidents in the history of these United States, that would be Bush 43, Shrub, as they call him. He made the dumbest being that Islam is a religion of peace. The second dumbest was that, you know, he looked into the soul of Vladimir Putin when he looked into his eyes and saw a devout Christian. I think they had a bromance going on, but that's a topic for a different day.
Interesting that he was also critical of Putin there, sometimes seen positively by that philosophical camp. But let's learn more about Steve Bannon, his views, and his influence in the White House so far with New York Times correspondent Scott Shane, who wrote a Bannon profile in November, and Eliana Johnson, who recently joined Politico from National Review. She has an article this week called The Man Behind Trump, Still Steve Bannon. Hi, Scott. Hi, Eliana. Welcome back, both of you, to WNYC.
Thanks, Brian.
Thank you.
And listeners, what do you want to say or ask about Steve Bannon and his influence on U.S. policy now? 212-433-WNYC. 212-433-9692. Scott, can you put those clips we played into context? Are they part of a larger Bannon worldview, particularly with respect to Islam, not just radical Islam?
I guess if I had to sum up Steve Bannon's worldview from, you know, what he's said and written over the years, the sort of domestic component would be that the elites, the political and financial elites, have essentially exploited the working class and the middle class and need to be overthrown. We could talk about how that fits in with the billionaires in the Trump cabinet, but that he said that many times, especially to Tea Party groups over the years. And then internationally, you know, I think his biggest theme is that what he calls the Judeo-Christian West is at war, in a global war with radical Islam. And sometimes he drops the radical and just says Islam. And occasionally he's very well read, and you know, he'll cite history. And in one talk, he went back to Vienna and Tours, the city in France, both sites of famous battles between Christians and Muslims, in which the Christians, you know, stopped Muslim invaders. And so he connects the kind of current era with those kinds of apocalyptic kind of confrontations, clash of civilizations between Muslims and Christians, you know, centuries ago.
And Eliana, do you think we see that sneering sarcasm about Islam translated into policy and legalese in the 90-day travel ban?
You know, I think that in part of Bannon's worldview, there's an aspect of intentional provocation, overstatement, and so dropping the radical Islam and just saying Islam, and this idea that attacking, even destroying sacred cows is a good thing. I think that's what attracted him to Trump in part. And so I think you did see that with the sort of shock and awe of these executive orders, which some people have said, you know, are more showmanship than actual you know, policy muscle. So I think you really do see Steve Bannon's fingerprints on, particularly on these executive orders about immigration, and a real desire to show that Trump meant what he said on the campaign trail and will follow through on it. These are as much messaging tools to the Trump base as they are serious policy documents.
Scott, as your profile points out, Bannon went to a military Catholic school as a kid in Richmond, Virginia, was a naval officer, then went to Harvard Business School and worked for Goldman Sachs and also started his own investment firm, made a fortune apparently by investing in Seinfeld reruns. There was some foresight. He's still profiting from that, I guess. He's 63 years old and describes himself as an economic nationalist, but not a white nationalist. You also say respect for his father, who's still alive at 95 and they're close, who is a telephone lineman, motivates him in some way. Can you talk about that?
Sure. He was a telephone. His dad was a telephone lineman initially, and eventually worked his way up into sort of middle management at the telephone company. But you know, he sees himself as a representative of sort of average working people, the middle class. And you know, many people who know him says that a turning point for him was the 2008 financial crisis, which, you know, in his view, the sort of the financial elite weathered very well, but people like his dad, who apparently, you know, lost some of the value of his retirement accounts, you know, really suffered, and that sort of lit his fire. As you say, he became quite wealthy in the business world, and then you know, got into producing movies and doing various jobs in Hollywood, and then sort of gradually moved into the political sphere, first by making documentary films, and subsequently when he took over Breitbart News, the right-wing news site, and that was sort of, I guess you could say, the launching pad that now has landed him via Donald Trump at the White House.
Eliana, picking up on the economic side of Bannon that Scott was just talking about, there are contradictions here, it seems to me, and I wonder if it's not just Bannon, but kind of the, you know, that wing of conservative economic populists generally, and maybe you can help explain it. Like, they disdain Wall Street, but they want Dodd-Frank repealed or weakened, which is what Wall Street banks want. They want little guys like Bannon's father not to get screwed by the powerful, but I think they oppose minimum wage laws. They oppose Democratic Party programs like free public college for working class Americans and some kind of national health insurance law, if not Obamacare, something that smooths out the ravages of the private marketplace and doesn't give as much power to insurance companies. Do you understand it? Do you get how those things hang together?
I'm actually not sure that the economic views that that you just laid out are those of Steve Bannon and Donald Trump. Trump said repeatedly on the campaign trail that he opposed entitlement reform, touching Medicare and Medicaid, and I'm not sure with what Steve Bannon's views on the minimum wage are, but it would not surprise me to hear that he supported a minimum wage. I just don't know the particulars of his economic views. I think it's fair to say that traditional conservative economic views, which are what you just laid out, sort of the trickle-down theory of economics, are not those of Steve Bannon and Donald Trump, and that he's really seeking to replace neoconservative foreign policy views and conservative free market economic views with an entirely different ideology, which is, much more friendly to, much more liberal. And so I would not equate the two. I think precisely as Scott said, that he sees himself as a tribune of the working class and an enemy sort of bureaucrats, bankers, the Davoisie, Davos attending people, academics, and it's just not clear to me what precisely his views are on economic policy.
The Davoisie. And Scott, this is in your article too. You write about contradictions within Bannon, and you ask, for example, why does a man who calls himself a hard-nosed capitalist rail against globalists and the party of Davos, as he calls it? So how would you begin to answer that question?
On economics, it really is a bit of a puzzle. Some of the things that certainly President Trump and some of those he's appointed seem to stand for, and certainly Republican Congress stands for, seem to be at odds with things Bannon has said. One of the things that struck me in November, I listened to a whole lot of Steve Bannon. A lot of his speeches to the Tea Party groups and that kind of thing are on YouTube. And one of the things that you find is that you could take, three, four, five sentences at a time, and if I showed it to someone who was up to speed on American politics, they would not be able to tell me whether that was Bernie Sanders or Steve Bannon. So there is this sort of populist sticking up for the little man side to Bannon, or at least his rhetoric, and how that squares with some of what, we expect from President Trump and the Republican Congress is, it's very, very hard to figure out. But to amplify what Eliana said about Bannon in terms of style, we may be looking too hard at for consistent policies. Like President Trump, this is a guy with a background to a degree in showbiz. He, produced a bunch of films. He certainly understands symbols. He understands messaging. And there is this streak. A guy who worked with him on a documentary years ago talked about how they got into a bit of an argument over whether the documentary had to be cut further. It was, 2 hours and 15 minutes, and he said, look, we can't. It has to be shorter, and Bannon didn't want to cut it. And he said Bannon turned the table they were sitting at over. He said one thing about Steve is everything has to be a fight. And I think, when you think about what he said to my colleague in the New York Times the other day, that the media is the opposition party. I mean, he's, this is all very intentional. I think when, many folks looked at the immigration order and talked about bungling and it didn't go through the proper process and it was surprised the leaders at DHS and the State Department actually have to carry it out and treated that as a big mistake. But I think it's fair, as Eliana suggests, to assume that in Bannon's view this is not a mistake, that the whole idea was to rally the base, to make liberals cry out in pain and on with the revolution.
My guests are New York Times correspondent Scott Chain and Politico correspondent Eliana Johnson. As we look at the record and influence in the White House so far of Steve Bannon, 212-433-WNYC. Our lines are full right now, but you can get in as people finish up. And we'll start with Josh in Midtown. Josh, you're on WNYC. Hello.
Yeah, hi. How are you?
Okay, thank you.
So I listen to you every day. I'm trying to, make sense of all this. And, one of the things I want to know is, so let's say Bannon, he wants to make liberals cry out. He sounds purposeful. He clearly thinks he's brilliant. I mean, he's very taken with himself. And then what I see happens is people say, well, you know, he's a brilliant guy. He knows what he's doing. What I want to know is, what is he missing? Like, what are the consequences of his behavior that he doesn't see? You know, what are potential backfires?
Politically?
Yeah, I mean, politically, you know, politically and even events that could happen that he just doesn't see as possible that could happen that would surprise him.
That's a big question. Did you also tell our screener that you had a question, who is Trump to Bannon?
Yes, I did. You know, who is Trump to Bannon? Because, you know, he was making fun of Bush, saying that he wasn't intelligent, that he said stupid things. I mean, the problem that I'm having with Trump, you know, I listened to your, you know, conservative listeners, and I just don't get what people see in Trump. You know, he doesn't even seem to know who Frederick Douglass is.
Josh, I'm gonna leave it there, and let's take that second Josh question, which I think is more of a manageable one to actually maybe get an answer to, Eliana. Who is Trump to Bannon? And if Bannon thinks George W. Bush was stupid, does he think Trump is intelligent?
Yeah, it's a great question. I think if people are trying to understand Trump through a traditional Republican-Democrat political framework, they're not going to be able to understand him. I think the best way to understand Trump is as a third party candidate or president. He's, you know, a politician like the country's never really seen before. He's a nationalist populist who's sort of running a coalition government where he's going to agree with Republicans in Congress on some things and agree with Democrats on other things. But to try to understand him through the framework of Republican politics and policy, I think is misleading.
Right.
And I think Bannon is very similar. And I think Bannon was attracted to Trump because he exists outside of the traditional political framework and can really overthrow and affect an enormous amount of change in government because he's willing to flout norms and be entirely contradictory to everything we've seen come before this. Bannon's presence, the breaking down of the wall that has existed between politics and policy, where your political advisor doesn't sit on the National Security Council, I think is one example. But it, you know, it's just a small part of the changes I think we're going to see in the Trump presidency.
I agree with that. And Scott, you referred at one point in your article to Trump as Bannon's Reagan. What did you mean by that?
Well, you know, I was interested to discover that, first of all, that as a young naval officer, Bannon got very excited by Ronald Reagan. He was from a Democratic family, traditionally Democratic family, but like a lot of Democrats, they went for Reagan. And he happened to talk his way into, with a couple friends, into Reagan's sort of election night victory party in 1980. And it was clearly a formative, you know, memorable experience for him. Subsequently, he made a film called In the Face of Evil, which is essentially a kind of hagiographic portrait of Reagan as a very strong leader facing off against the global menace of communism. And I think, you know, what there's evidence that he sort of tried out various politicians as potential vehicles for the ideas that he wanted to press. And, you know, so he made films about Michelle Bachmann and Sarah Palin. He talked to a number of other folks who were considering presidential runs. But clearly there was a kind of kinship between him and Trump in terms of their love for the spectacular, their love for being contrarian. I guess and also one thing, you know, that a guy who didn't want to be named, but who's quite close to Bannon, and who said to Bannon during the campaign, you know, basically, Trump is an idiot. Why are you supporting this guy? He has no knowledge of policy or anything else. And Bannon, in defending his decision to go with Trump, called Trump an imperfect vessel, which President Trump might take some offense at. But the idea of a vessel is something empty that you pour something into. And, you know, for as long as this relationship lasts, I think, you know, Steve Bannon, who is full of ideas and is, whatever else you say about him, is very well informed on a lot of things, does a lot of reading, he's going to pour his ideas into Donald Trump, and we'll see how that comes out. The other thing, I guess, that the caller made me think about, we were talking about how this executive order was, you know, kind of a political act, an act of defiance and showmanship and, you know, carrying out a campaign promise. And it was certainly signaling to Trump's base that, you know, you heard me promise that I was going to get tough on immigration and on Muslims, and that's exactly what we're doing. I guess the thing that disturbs people in the counterterrorism world that I've covered for a long time is that, you know, you may be signaling to your American base, you're also signaling to a lot of other folks. And ISIS and al-Qaeda, of course, push and thrive on the idea that the U.S. is at war with Islam. You know, and they say all Muslims have to join our cause because there's nowhere else to go. You know, the U.S. is against you. Both President Bush, George W. Bush, and President Obama were very careful to separate al-Qaeda and ISIS on the one hand from the great mass of Muslims on the other hand.
And by the way, the Times has a really interesting article today about Putin and how careful he is to do that. When he talks about radical Islamist extremists, he makes a point of saying, I'm not talking about Islam. And he doesn't use that language of, you know, radical Islamic terrorism that Trump and the Republican Party generally prefer, but rather tries to go the way of violent political extremists, things like that, that President Obama and the Democrats do. So it's interesting that that comes from Putin.
Yeah, we actually have a story in today's New York Times about the sort of school of, I think it's fair to call, anti-Muslim sentiments and views that has thrived on the political right, but sort of on the fringe for many, many years. And that school, I think it's fair to say, has sort of moved into the White House between Bannon talking about, you know, this global war against Islamic radicalism and Michael Flynn, the National Security Advisor, who tweeted at one point last year, "Fear of Muslims is rational." You know, they have kind of stepped outside the traditional or the, you know, the sort of White House stance of the previous two presidents, who were very careful to separate Islam from terrorism.
I have to,
and now they're sort of being conflated.
I have to go to a short break, but I actually want to pick up with both of you on exactly that point when we come back, and ask if you get the sense that the travel ban is just the start of something bigger. It is only temporary, 90 days, and it is only with respect to seven countries. Is it the start of something bigger with respect to Muslims in or out of this country that we can expect from Bannon and Trump? So get ready for that question, and listeners will take more of your calls, too, as we continue on Steve Bannon with Scott Shane from The New York Times and Eliana Johnson from Politico. Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Brian Lehrer on WNYC. We're talking about the role of Steve Bannon in the Trump administration and looking at his beliefs with Scott Shane, New York Times correspondent, who wrote a lengthy profile of Bannon in the Times in November, and Eliana Johnson, who recently joined Politico from National Review. She's got an article this week called "The Man Behind Trump, Still Steve Bannon." For listeners who are just tuning in, which would be a lot of people from when we started a half hour ago, I want to replay the montage of things Steve Bannon has said that mostly have to do with war and Islam that USA Today put together this week. These are things Bannon said on his Breitbart radio show, which he gave up when he joined the campaign.
You know, George Bush walked out after 9/11 in front of a mosque that's religion of peace and go shopping, right? We haven't had an adult conversation. And by the way, some of these conversations may get a little unpleasant. But you know what? We're in a war. We're clearly going into, a major shooting war in the Middle East again. It's war. It's war. Every day we put up America's at war. America's at war. We're at war. Note to self, beloved Commander-in-Chief, we're at war.
You have an expansionist Islam and you have an expansionist China, right? They are motivated. They're arrogant. They're on the march and they think the Judeo-Christian West is on the retreat. Talk to us about this mosque in the North Pole.
Various Steve Bannon clips from about the last year and a half on Breitbart Radio before he joined the Trump campaign last summer. Eliana Johnson, I want to pick up on one of the lines in that when he said he thinks we're headed for another major shooting war in the Middle East. He, from everything I know, hated the Iraq war, hates George W. Bush for, among other things, squandering so much American money on the Iraq war when people like his working class father could use that spent on them to get by. And now he seems to, at least in that one line, and I don't want to take it too much out of context, but it seems to fit in the context of the travel ban and other things that he said, of almost goading us into another major shooting war in the Middle East. Does this fit together in any way that you understand?
I think it does. I think you need to note that Bannon has been extremely critical not only of the foreign policy of George W. Bush, but also of the foreign policies of Barack Obama. And I think you could really see this come through in Trump's inaugural address, where he was tacitly critical, really, of the bipartisan foreign policy consensus that has existed in the post-World War II era. And I think what came through there was that the America's role as the provider of stability, the policeman of the world, has not served the middle class in this country. And I think what you're going to see under Trump, you're starting to see it, in this friendliness with Russia and other great powers that potentially could take the U.S.'s place elsewhere in the world, is a retreat back to American shores, a building of walls around this country. And I actually don't think Bannon would be a proponent of U.S. involvement in shooting wars around the world. I think he wants – I think America First is meant literally. It's intended, as a real isolationist sentiment, and he thinks his involvement in wars have really hurt the working classes.
So when Trump says we're going to destroy ISIS and quickly – is that something Bannon would try to talk him out of in a military sense?
No, I don't think they're mutually exclusive. I think you're going to see Trump follow something of an Obama policy, which is extremely reluctant to use ground troops, but to take a very strong posture, stronger than Obama in terms of his words and his self-presentation. But I think that this administration will be incredibly reluctant to put boots on the ground anywhere around the world.
Jim and Seacliff, you're on WNYC. Hi, Jim.
Hello.
Hi, Jim. Yep, we can hear you.
Fantastic. I just want to ask your guest. Last Friday was Holocaust Memorial Remembrance Day, and I believe it was Mr. Bannon who made a speech or issued an address and failed to mention Jews.
Right. And I'm gonna go because the line is terrible, but this is a question we've been getting a lot, Scott. The statement, I think it was a written statement for Holocaust Remembrance Day, which in the past, coming from the White House, has mentioned Jews in particular, and in this case didn't. So it wasn't Holocaust denial with respect to the Jews, but it's something that Jews are very wary of when some people who want to downplay the Holocaust against the Jews, the genocide against the Jews, kind of put the Holocaust in general terms, you know, Germany's victimization of so many people. So it had that smell to some Jews. Was that Steve Bannon's work, and was that something that was intentionally intended to convey that message?
You know, I'm not certain of that, and Eliana might have more insight into it. I will say that, you know, Bannon ran the Breitbart News website prior to joining the campaign just last August, and, you know, that site, whatever Bannon's personal feelings are about different religious and ethnic minorities and immigrants and Muslims and so on, that site is, it's fair to say, thrives on provocation, on incitement, and often uses headlines, has used headlines that are offensive to Jews, offensive to Muslims, offensive to African Americans, offensive to women. And, you know, whether that was a deliberate provocation or, you know, just sort of a clumsy misstep of a new administration, I don't know. Eliana, do you have any insight into that?
Yeah, my only insight is that the statement was not written by Bannon, but it's very difficult, I think, to get in the minds of these people and know whether it was intentionally provocative or whether the administration merely overlooked the inclusion of, you know, a specific reference to Jews. But I do think it's fair to say this is an administration that clearly doesn't have you know, specific procedures in place to run, you know, any statement about the Holocaust by X number of people or any, even its press statements by, you know, the 15 people who are supposed to see it. So I do think we know that, but I don't know whether it was intentional.
Alexis in Philadelphia, you're on WNYC. Hello, Alexis.
Hi, Brian. Thank you for taking my call. This topic is a bit of my obsession right now, and I think that I don't know what you would call it. The elevation of Bannon to the entity is particularly worrisome. But I wanted to sort of ask or comment on, after the White Nationalist Conference that occurred right after Trump's election, I remember reading an article from NPR where I believe it was Richard Spencer who had said that their goal was like a 50-year ban on immigration with the exception of Christians from some European countries. And, you know, the article was referencing the connection to Bannon as well as how Jeff Sessions was the ideal AG for this agenda to go through in the U.S. And it's also the same article in which I believe it was Jared Taylor who referred to Trump as a vessel, like Scott just mentioned previously, that they admitted that even though he wasn't a white nationalist, they saw him as a vessel through which their ideals and policy could take life in our country.
So your question is, how much do you think that that those things are really Bannon's goals?
Yes, and how, you know, is in what you said right before the break, you know, is the refugee ban from these seven countries or the Muslim ban from these seven countries just sort of a first step toward this 50-year ban on, you know, all but Europeans to reestablish the 80 to 90% white Christian balance in our country?
Alexis, thank you. And so let's go right to that question. Scott, are there any indications to think that this 90-day ban that's supposed to assess terrorism risks from seven mostly Muslim countries and people coming here from there, just the start of something bigger with respect to Muslims and maybe even Mexicans in or out of this country?
You know, I don't think we know for sure yet. There has been talk about extending that ban on visas for some countries and maybe not for others. You know, this is a kind of a trial balloon, I suppose, and they may assess how it was received. But it's certainly unnerving to a lot of folks that it, you know, who are not convinced that this is a kind of temporary one-time measure. I don't think, you know, Bannon has a few times described himself, as you noted at the outset, as an economic nationalist, not a white nationalist. And he has mildly distanced himself from kind of the outright racism and xenophobia of people like Richard Spencer, who the caller mentioned, and the alt-right, so-called. But, you know, he's played it down. He's sort of been dismissive of it. He said every movement, picks up some fringe characters, but that doesn't define the movement and so on. But he hasn't, you know, what he hasn't done that I think we've seen politicians and their top aides do in the past is sort of draw a bright line and clearly distance himself from these
right.
Extreme voices.
But I would almost make a distinction between two different kinds of white nationalism, if you will. The old KKK style, which maybe that Richard Spencer rally still represents, is primarily aimed in this country against blacks and Jews. What might be the Bannon style is more of a sort of Euro-Judeo-Christian nationalism, where they think that Western, European, Judeo-Christian, Western values and culture are under attack. Muslims in large numbers from anywhere are unassimilable. Latin Americans in large numbers are unassimilable. And those are the lines that he's really trying to draw to protect not just strict economic things like not too many immigrants so there isn't downward pressure on wages, things like that, but the sense of a white Judeo-Christian European culture that they think is uniquely valuable and is under threat with that much immigration. Is that – you think I'm off base there?
I think you've put it very well. I mean, one thing that you see when you look back at Bannon is, you know, some similarities and some ties to the kind of nationalist parties that have arisen in Europe and similar attitudes. You know, there is a real kind of coalition. A lot of those folks are big fans of Donald Trump. So I think that's right. You shouldn't really think of sort of cross-burning and the KKK. You should think more about these new-style conservative nationalist leaders who have thrived on the resentment of immigration into Europe. You know, of course, far fewer immigrants have come to this country, relatively speaking. And, you know, in Germany, which accepted 1 million refugees, you know, that's just a totally different scale from what we're mm-hmm, seeing in this
right.
country, but the feelings are very similar.
And we're just about out of time. We're really over time. But, Eliana, we haven't mentioned on the program today in any of our segments the incident at Berkeley last night and Milo Yiannopoulos, who's a Breitbart guy in general, and we don't have time for me to go through the whole history of Yiannopoulos and how he was banned for life by Twitter for trolling Leslie Jones after Ghostbusters and all you know, this stuff. I think anti-feminist and anti-LGBT, even though he's gay himself, provocation, anti-political correctness provocation is Milo Yiannopoulos' main thing. But is he a Bannon disciple as somebody who became big at Breitbart doing all this stuff?
He is, and I think that this hits on another aspect of Bannon's strategy, which is not only to displace conservatism with nationalism and populism, but to provoke the left in a way that pushes them further left. And so with Milo being shut down and kicked out, I think it brings forth some untoward aspects of the opposition to Trump and to Bannon and their movement that I think in Bannon's eyes makes them look ridiculous, brings out the fringe aspects.
I agree. I think he got exactly what he was after at Berkeley last night, didn't he?
Exactly. And I think that you're going to see that more and more. I think there was an aspect of that to the executive order where these things are very closely held, privately held, and then dropped like, you know, a 1,000-pound bomb. And because they're a little bit disorganized, there are some mistakes in it, the opposition loses its mind and behaves in ways that make them look bad, and the attention shifts to that.
All right. To be continued. Eliana Johnson from Politico, Scott Shane from The New York Times, thank you so much for giving us so much time today.
Thanks, Brian.
Thank you.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Coming up next, we'll see what happens in vaccine court. This is a real thing. Stay with us.